I lived here from 1939 to 1957, and many of you have said that you purchased the book. Proceeds are dedicated to the village. I'm going to take you in the next 55 minutes before Vespers through a couple trays of slides so that you can kind of get an overview of what this place was like. You know the logistics, the difficulties of getting here. You experience them yourself. These were the ways into this remote mineral property that was discovered in the summer of 1896. Those were the railroads, and there's the possibilities for getting it all the way from Holden to Tacoma to the smelter. The logistics of moving this mineral out of the Lake Chelan region, of course, after 1896 was one of the problems faced by J.H. Holden and several speculative companies that you can read about in the book, weather being one of them. This is the Stehekin Valley by an airplane looking back down towards where you got off on the boat. And it's the head of the lake. And you can see that it's impossible to make a railroad. Transportation costs are the major factor in dealing with the price per pound of copper. This and the opening slide are from Mike Brogan, who's here this week with his sons, from his father Frank's little book pamphlet that you can, it's available. He's an excellent, it's a wonderful family, and he was an excellent illustrator that says it all for the way the town was set up. The main town site and the miners' village, which we call Winston Camp, built by Winston Construction Company, and the mine where it is. This is the road you traveled up to come to Holden. There's the 90 acres of tailings that was reached through compromise with the state of Washington alongside Railroad Creek. And there is some stain on the between here and Lake Chelan. To the right is the 10-mile creek basin, and beyond Holden, as you can see, is the country that you hike in, Heart Lake and Holden Lake. That's in reverse, obviously, and I'm sorry. But the fall is truly spectacular in the Pacific Northwest. And this was the town that was constructed. Let's see if we get a focus here. If we're not, we're not. This was the town that was created in 1937-38 that you live in today. And these are some of the facilities as they were just finished. Larry Penworthy, whose photos are in the museum, Larry Penworthy took this photo as well, and this was taken from the top of a tree at the beyond the grade school at the edge of town. Penworthy took many pictures before World War II. He hiked in here after graduating from the University of Washington and became an assayer, a very important job, because that's where the final computations on that gave the company its profit as it shipped it out to the smelter in Tacoma. When he was taken into the war, they came and got him because he was a specialist, and he left for the war, and people thought when the government came to get him that he was a secret agent for a foreign government. Actually, he was being shipped off to do work on what would be known as the Manhattan Project. But this is the way the town looked as a town site came into existence. This is the area, the 103 homes that I lived in, called the Winston Camp or Miner's Village. You remember the rock wall at the end of this, just before you go into it? That was the folks' residence there around their home. This is where, as I said before, that families put it all together. The roads were kept open, and it's part of getting the ore out. I left here like so many other people did in 57, and thank heavens, the more you look back on it, what a greater gift was given humanity than the inside of the good luck of having a Wes Priebe and all of the other people who came here to put this town back into motion and give it the joy and give you and I and everybody else such rich experiences for the last 30 years. And one of them they gave to the people of the Northwest and the state of Washington was an opportunity for the records to be saved. And we inventoried them, and the board of directors of the Holden Board of Directors declared that records that probably should be stored in an archives in the University of Washington, and sent a man up with me. And we inventoried them, and we got them inventoried, and the board said, yes, you could move them. So we came up one fall day, and another fellow and I, and we put them in a bus and hauled them out. It took a couple days to put them in the bus, and they had to bring a special boat up to bring them down. No sooner did we get these mining records out from underneath the dining hall than a water pipe broke and flooded those records. They are a microcosmic example of economic development in the Northwest between 1938 and 1957. So there they were, and they had to be cleaned up, and they are now available to anybody who wants to research. My father was the 10th employee. This numbered on the 10, hired by Howe Sound. That's him with me, shortly after I was brought to this town in the summer of 1939. And probably a few weeks older than that, obviously. He's taken some time off to come down here to the coffee shop for coffee. It's always important for you to see yourself in the context of your, you know, origins, but there it is. And we grew up in the snow. It was quite an experience to see the dirt. So men and women brought their families and raised them, had a nice community center here in a town. Very little, there was hardly any crime, doors were not locked. You weren't here but to work, and be very hard on you to leave. Although that decision had to be made. It's my lovely mother who, on our 25th commemoration voyage to the village, began to start her long nightmare with Alzheimer's after that beautiful day we spent courtesy of the village and some of the former residents. Those are real special times in people's lives, and just like you will experience when you leave the village, you will realize it is a place apart. It's been my good fortune over the years, as I lived down at the town of Chelan, where I was going to high school for a couple of years, and in my junior senior year, to have stood in as a godfather for different churches for so many children. Of course, that was 30 years ago. They have families of their own now. We all look a little bit different when we're growing up. We were forced to move to Kashmir. Wasn't forced, actually. We, you know, like everybody else, we had to find a job and get out of there. Ida College. My father died on Lincoln's birthday of 1957, so he didn't have to feel the pain of having to wait it out. You know, he knew it was coming, but he died. This is the man who discovered Holden. This is J.H. Holden, who put some years in before he finally find the Green Glint way high up on above Honeymoon Heights in the snowfield. It led to his discovery. These are examples of slides of Holden over the years coming west. Here he is on his way up to his claims high above the mine portal. And these are examples of his, you've seen these, and I think you've seen some of these kinds of stocks. I think there's one on at the museum. What a lovely museum. I enjoyed it this afternoon with my friends. These are the kinds of things a person would do in those days. Here's a man who's poor Irish and Catholic, who wants desperately to get ahead, and he's semi-literate, but he portrays himself as being English and Episcopalian, and creates a stock company. By that time, the scene shifted to the Yukon, so he sets into the mining capital of the Inland Empire, Spokane. With his main office in Chelan, he works with other people to secure money. He's a tremendous promoter. He had, as you will find out from reading the book, you will find that he knew how to link into people. He had come from the East Coast and he had worked around. So he knew how to, he wasn't afraid of going out and asking people to make illustrations for his stock brochures. Well, one of the best things that Holden did was the way in which he promoted and the way in which he, the people who he leased to, middlemen, helped to advance the prospect of this remote mineral at that time, and it was a low-grade abundant copper property, and he had to figure some way out of getting it. There you can see one of the proposals is to take a narrow-gauge railroad switchback train over onto Domke Mountain and then switch back across the Railroad Creek and up along Lightning Ridge and then back from Lightning Ridge around into the valley that you traveled up. An example, in your research, you actually find photos of the people who took some time out and actually, you know, earned some money by doing this. If you looked off of one of the switchbacks on the side of the road, you'll see it all grown over. That's a part of the railroad grade that was put in. The idea was to dress up the mining claims and to get, you know, illustrate what could be done if somebody with a lot of money came along in terms of, you know, making this low-grade abundant ore move. The railroad would not be completed north to the Canadian border until 1914. So you were facing tremendous transportation problems. This is an example of way up on the hillside. This is an example of Holden and his wife, the superintendent of the Episcopal Sunday School in Chelan, visiting this property, which was leased to Drummers Development Company 1901 to 1903. Each succession, Drummers to Granby to House Sound, constantly improves the property until it finally goes into production. You should never underestimate anybody. This was after Drummers left the area, shut down their Chelan Transportation Smelting Company, and then turned the property back on a lease basis to Holden. Holden bought the home of the president of the Chelan Transportation Smelting Company, and he moved his family from Iowa out here and set him up from his lease income as a dairyman. Here's the inside of the home. They used their leased income to travel to California and all over. They sponsored the Chelan Etude Society. He did that personally. And as I said before, he's from Iowa. He brought his mother and father, who were ailing, and they lived out their life in this wonderful house. Those are hop vines. They not only give you a nice aroma, they also give you a nice feeling once in a while. That was part of his property. One of the big cover-ups in the Northwest that cost J.P. Graves, the principal backer and financier of Whitworth College in Spokane, his leadership in the Granby Company came from an industrial cover-up in 1906 when he secretly lease-optioned the Holden mine. And, of course, that upgraded the scale of equipment and et cetera. And here you see the special agent for Graves on the left front row, with J.H. Holden as they're meeting with Cruz. This was big news in those days. And they did extensive development work down to about 1911, when they found, until they found in Rosslyn, B.C., a second ore body below the one that was supposedly bottoming out. But that gave this Washington State property tremendous notoriety. You can see here 4-5 represents two different tunneling operations into the top vein. And they found what was $1 million worth of ore. He was holding on a summer vacation into California. He took some of his money and spent his winters in California. When he didn't, he took his parents all over on cruises. He and his wife and kids spent the winters in California. And this is the way he saw himself. And that's fine. And just trying to find somebody who would finally come up with the big bucks, buy him out, and start a mine. Granby did release the mine just before World War I, but when the war broke out, Granby Company decided not to go forward. Holden was in difficult trouble. He had had great success with Granby. They were the Northwest. They held the largest smeltering operation at Trail in the British Empire, until that smeltering operation was shut down in the 20s. So that was a great name, but he needed money desperately during World War I, and he found a young man named Crooker Perry, who had just come back in February from visiting his mother in San Francisco with $20,000 in lottery money for that month. And so Holden borrowed $7,500 of it at 10% interest and secured it with half of his stock. This allowed him to fight off miners' liens and then also merchant liens, and continue to go forward. Granby Company came back and took one last look at it in 1917. But being a Canadian mining syndicate, with leadership by Graves of Spokane as general manager, vice president, now gone, fired because of his misappropriation of his responsibility, they nevertheless looked at it one more time in 1917. They remember Canada had sent the best of its people off much earlier to World War I. And they, like other European parties to that conflict, finally were getting war-weary We entered in 17. You know, these Canadian people, the investors, said, this war isn't going to go on much longer. We're not going to invest. Handed it back to Holden. By this time, Crooker Perry was not getting any money. Holden had cancer, and he would die in the spring of 1918 at Soap Lake of cancer. Perry was left with a problem of reorganizing. He had come to the area in 1909, and he had planted a young orchard along the lake, and he had left his father's Chicago lumber and hardware business, set himself up with his own family at Lake Chelan, and was doing rather well, but he was a businessman, not a prince promoter prospector. He was a businessman. He wanted to see the economy of the North Central Washington area integrated. And so he was willing to take a chance on Holden because it was an industry that would offset tourism and agricultural development. Crooker Perry finally found himself having to put over $21,000 of his own money into trying to recover on his $7,500 loan. He did reorganize the Holden Gold and Copper Company, the Lake Chelan Copper Company. He did a very sensitive job of converting stock for those who responded, and then proceeded on his own through the 20s to find somebody who would buy it. And one of the reasons that he decided to go for it was because Granby, on the final lease, had come up with a second zone of ore. From the top to the second, they had found now potential of two zones of ore, two bodies of ore, that gave them over 2 million tons of concentrate. They needed to have that, someone needed to confirm that second body. That would give it a tremendous lifespan if anybody put it in production. Well, Holden knew that the railroads would not be the way to go. He, in fact, said that trucks were the option in the future to the cost, prohibitive cost, of running railroad transport into the area. So Granby came and looked once more in 1927, and finally one of the former engineers for Granby, C.B. Brennan, whose papers are now, by coincidence, we found them in New York State and bought them for $1,100. They're in our state library. C.B. Brennan, who had worked for Granby, came over to work for Britannia Beach over in Vancouver. Britannia Beach said, we'll take a look at it in 28. And they looked at it and they said, it's one of the three best in the Northwest. We'll exercise a lease option for $250,000, and if we want to buy it, we'll take half the stock and we'll pay the other half of the ownership off if we do it in four equal installments in 1932. In the meantime, they moved a great number of people to the property. This time, instead of small three-shift crews, they moved over 100 people up on the hillside, way above the valley floor, to begin to really probe, and they confirmed not only the second zone of ore, but the third block of ore. 1928 to 32, very critical for everybody because, as you know from your own study of history, the Depression sets in, global economy and chaos, and one of the consequences is the German cartels move rather swiftly across the planet. Here's a low-grade property located in a scenic remote area, now held by British Columbia mining men, leasing it again. British Columbia mining men whose off headquarters has now been shifted from their historic mining property at Britannia Beach on the Howe Sound coast north of Vancouver to New York City. They are an international mining syndicate, very concerned about where things go, along with Anaconda, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they decide, the government of the United States decides, and the other allies decide on a free world strategy to subsidize and protect these low-grade properties. And so Holden's right in there. In the meantime, Howe Sound continues to work on putting together, you know, the crews to figure out what to do. They have a pretty good idea by 1932 that they want it, so they buy it in four equal installments of about $75,000 a piece at 6 months intervals with a $2,500 fine, and Perry gets $161,000 out of it, which he throws into the bank in Chelan, the Miners and Merchants Bank, which helps to save during the run on the banks in the 30s, along with R.B. Fields and Leavenworth Washington's Bank, the only two banks that did not go under during that depression. This happens to be an auxiliary power plant that was created up above by the ballpark. Now I'm going to share with you tonight something that nobody in the village has ever seen, and I'm glad that I could do this with you. A few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, it's hard to tell, time flies when you're having so much fun. A lady from San Jose got a hold of me and said, I've read your book and I find you credible. Therefore, I'm about ready to hand you some photos of when I was there between 1928 and 32 with my husband, and I was the only woman there. So she handed them to me. We spent a lovely afternoon at her daughter's home in North Seattle, and what we had was some slides of the way Lucerne looked, and especially how they put the tramway in up over the grade while they were exploring and making the decision between 28 and 32. And I hope you enjoy these. This is quite and this is the first road punched into Holden. This is the way Lucerne Resort looked before it was required to go backwards in time, according to U.S. government regulations. And these are just the dance hall and the places that people stayed. Of course, the yacht club has its base in there today, and they're doing fine. A couple of the people out there on their motorboats. Okay, she didn't have anything to do. She was living way up on the hillside, way up in Honeymoon Heights, and she was getting bored out of her skull. So she hiked down and took these pictures, and we're going to go up on that hillside in a minute. Now there we are, looking down on Lucerne, and we're going to build a tramway from that top of that bluff, and we might as well have at it. So we're going up that ravine over there behind the boat docks and up towards what is called Dance Camp, and it's very hard to see it right now in those slides, but there's the tramway. And we're going to work our way into that ravine. Now we're going to clear the brush off that ravine to put that tramway in and lay the tracking. This has to be a wonderful time to live, because it's nice to be able to look around and be able to say, see, I built that. I helped build that. This is a great adventure in the 1930s, early 1931, 32. Look at all this equipment they move up there just to build this tramway. Old docking. They have a lot of material to move up. Timber, oil, compressors, drill equipment on these sleds. And so, you know, there they are. There's their skips. So you see, it's one thing to hear it and read it. It's another thing to see it. Of course, a packer working, hauling stuff in on his pack train, who did Gordon Stewart, the second man with the second number. They used to give you a hiring number on tin to keep track of you. He had number two, apparently. That's what he said. Well, although people did not take kindly to Gordon Stewart years later because of his animosity towards the Holden residents, and he enjoyed taking their money, didn't like them having their boats up there. Well, you see, they're hauling a lot of equipment up this tramway, and they're trying to build it through this forest. And these fellows are, there's no particular order here, it's just the way it goes, and I just thought I'd show them to you. And it must have been a hot summer, hot and dusty and dry, just like coming up the switchbacks today. But it's work, and it paid $5 a day, $5.50 a day, and in 1928 to 32, that's nothing to sneeze at. Had to skin your logs, and, you know, and cut your ties. Okay, and carry those. These are things that are going to be in place in a minute when we get up there. Had to winch all this up. Grand adventure. That's a little dark. Sorry about that. I remember this fellow who discovered this mine was J.H. Holden. Okay, while she's changing the slides. And he's been dead since 1918. Here it is, 1928 to 32, and Howe Sound is, you know, building a tramway. They're pretty serious about it, but all of a sudden in 1932, okay, they have to stop mining, and like so many companies, they're reduced to a skeleton frame of seven people in their International Mining Corporation. And until the Allies decide on a free world market, metal market strategy, these properties can't go forward. But these fellows in 1928 to 32 are really digging in, aren't they? They're really building in their systems, equipment systems. There they are, hunkering it into the hillside. Okay. Some of us are probably faint today looking at all that cribbing and bulwark those people put up. Have a whole different meaning to work today, don't we? We probably underestimate all the hard work that people that here at the Holden Village are doing for us behind the scenes. And that's why I think it behooves all of us when we hear from them every year to not hesitate. You know, I'm not Lutheran, but I do everything I can to promote Holden Village, and Lutherans hear from me in my neighborhood. My son's getting married to a Lutheran minister's daughter this weekend in Seattle, next weekend, and being converted this weekend. I was baptized in the Anglican Church, and being Scottish and from Roslyn, that's the way it goes. But, you know, probably will be, you know, I'm probably Lutheran, but don't know it. But that's okay. Well, there's a tramway going into position. There it is, over that bluff. It's quite a feat, isn't it, when you finally look at it? Until they decide what they're going to do, they can't build that switchback road, but they sure can now forget about building a narrow gauge railroad. So now they got to figure out the next strategy. Just thought I'd just show you these scenes. Okay. I'll hurry as fast as I can. I'm going to show these slides again at 10 o'clock over in the Koinonia for the staff. If you want to come over, it's going to be a very free-flowing discussion, because they have a lot of things that they pass on that might be wrong. Well, there you see the kind of, you know, logistics problem of getting all this equipment up the road, all the oil barrels and everything. Now we're going up the road. Remember all these railroad ties and this trail that went up to the mine? Well, that's the way it looked prior to putting a bulldozer to it and widening it. And that was the punching, you know, bridge they had built, that so many trails, so many horses and people had gone over carrying equipment since probably back before World War I, obviously. It's up above by the ballpark. You see, that's a real problem, isn't it? And they've got to replace that with better bridging. Well, there they go. This is quite a feat. You know, this is little things, you know. But when you find these things, you want to share them. There they are, starting to edge in the road on the way to Holden. And there's Gordon Stewart, packing his stuff in, complaining all the time as he takes his money to the bank. Well, that's great. That's America. Look at the old dirt, you know, trail. There they go, slowly but surely opening the road. Look at that. Now they're coming off that ridge over to the top of the hill called Dan's Camp. You could barely make out the road when we went by it today. Look at that. Must have been a marvelous time. Imagine all the stories where they joshed each other. This is a great moment. You go down in posterity if someone will cough up the picture. Building that road. Hauling that equipment out. Look at that. And there's Gordon Stewart. Got to buy a copy of that book. Well, you see, when they start on January 1st, 1937, after in 36 they decide, they do assessment work, and then they decide we're ready to go. They announce at the board of directors meeting in New York they're going to open the Holden mine. And so now they can go ahead in 1937 and build the switchback road and start building this town and this mill and this operation. And away they go. They've been fighting since 1928 with the state on where to put the concentrator and the tailings down at the lake and dump it like they had in Howe Sound, deep in Howe Sound in British Columbia, etc. Now these mining people from British Columbia, when you go to the mining museum at Britannia Beach, that you will finally make the connection of why they were able to put this mine in, because you see, they had done the same thing at Britannia Beach in the 1920s. They had rebuilt a mill just like, somewhat like this, but not on the same scale. But they'd also had to build a community that set on a valley way above Britannia Beach mine in Howe Sound. So they knew the logistics in doing this. That's the trade-off one has to make when one is, you know, jobs versus the environment, and that's Railroad Creek near the tailings area. And one of the things they had to worry about was the 50-year, 100-year floods. That's the 1948 flood as it blew out the truck bridge across Railroad Creek. And you had to worry about those things. In fact, they had no sooner got the dikes going for the first dikes for the tailing when they had a bust out of their first dike that stained the rocks. Most of the people from that time on saw the stained rocks in Railroad Creek and thought that there was too much sediment, concrete in the bottom and not up for the stream life. So the result was that not many people living in Holden ever fished the 12 miles between here and Lucerne. They thought the fish were polluted or tainted, and yet they were there, like Dole Lakes. And it was there and hardly, they were here to work and to, they were tired when they got done. Here's the Honeymoon Heights area being a, you know, had been winterized, now can be a staging area for moving people down to the town site. This is, of course, Honeymoon Heights. Christy Plimpton just did her master's thesis at the University of Washington State University on this community, this section of the story. There's the clearing of the mill area off, you know, to put in this 60,000 square feet of mill. Okay, the building of the power lines is, they wanted to make Donkey Lake a storage reservoir and then take the electricity, let it fall down through, turbines and generate it to their own electricity for the mine. But the state of Washington says, come on, we've got this Washington Water Power Dam and you're going to take our electricity. And that's the way it goes. But this is the building of the 1500 level, the haulage level that Professor Edmonds talks about when he talks with you. And they're winching everything in. So what happens is that many people who worked on the Grand Coulee Dam project were shifted over to work for companies over here, Isaacs and Steel and other places. Sorry I don't have these things in correctly right now. This was a hard rock mine, as Professor Edmonds will tell you, and as you read. So it means that once you get past the initial overburden of dirt, you can go through, you know, the rock is pretty hard and it'll hold up and you have to bolt it in places. And you go back a long ways and you're underneath the body. And so the first stage of mining is going to be by letting it fall down through chambers and moving it into ore cars. And you'll be able to get those first blocks of ore fairly soon. And they really hollow out some huge pockets. Here you see, on the left, you see the man with the butcher paper on an old tunnel. This is a Larry Penworthy picture. I dearly love the man. And you see that they've cut, they've undercut, they've worked their way up. Through that, you can see the open space. Well, my father fell down one of those things in the middle of World War II and was in a hospital for 6 months. The fellow didn't put up a barricade. I'm sorry about this lovely picture. But that's the town site, as you see it, in operation. I'll do my best here. I'm hurrying along so Vespers does. I don't think it's Vespers. That's a winter scene of taken from the road on the way to the mine of part of my neighborhood. And that's in backwards, but that gives you some idea of the homes that were up there in the wintertime. Okay. Obviously, we've got television. This is the age of television. Another one in backwards. Son of a gun, I got in a hurry over there when I was putting them in. But you get the idea. It was a very important stigma. You did not shovel your walks. You know, you were really held up for harassment. Kept a snow shovel back. You know, that's the size of I don't know what I did wrong here. I was just dumbed out, I guess, but that's okay. We'll turn them around next time. That's the way if you switched it, that's the way the miners, the 103 homes looked in up where it's all meadow today. And quite nice homes. And here's Honeymoon Heights. You know, a snow scene, you've seen that. And here's the hauling of the ore out, for some of you, out of the mine. Here are some of the miners. You see, the miners, once the government was going to subsidize low-grade copper properties, then this mine went into production and concentrate started for the first time flowing in April of 1938. The company couldn't take this ore out till they finally dropped the wages of the miners, forcing them in the 30s to unionize. And when because the smelter in Tacoma for the Northwest was a union smelter, and they did a nothing flat, and the wages went up, and people went to work. And here are the guys standing outside of one of the tunnels with keeping warm, swapping stories someday. Well, hunting, fishing, big experience. See pack trains coming in, people going deer hunting, usually bringing the deer back. Schools in place. That's a morning kill at Lyman Lake. In the fall before my father died, he took a pack horse and pulled it all the way about 25 miles over here to Image Lake, and then tied it up and hiked over to Canyon Lake, caught these fish, came back, took an hour's sleep, brought the horse back, killed two bear on the way back through Lyman Lake, and then came home. He had problems. He had injured himself lifting underground. He wasn't supposed to, and he broke a blood vessel, and he was having a hard time controlling that, which eventually led to his demise because he could never get it stopped. He had rheumatic fever bothered him. That's the mill. And, of course, the road in wintertime. And this is the way the dock looked with the concentrate and the ore trucks, you know, semi-wet, about 5.5 to 6 tons with the bucket included. And they would take those out, and they knew what the concentrate assayed at, so they knew what they were going to get down in Tacoma at the smelter. And that's the way they worked. And that dock was much longer, of course, than the one we got off at the boat. And anyway, you know, this is the first dance in this building right where you're sitting. This is a New Year's Eve ball. Everybody paid $2 a month out of their union dues. And Christmas, every child on alternating years got a $10 gift wrap brought in by Santa Claus, whose sleigh rattled the top of this tin roof as he ho-ho-hoed in here before everybody in town. Every kid that was born through the eighth grade got a $10 gift plus a stocking gift wrapped, and we had big community Christmas trees, and everybody sang, and everybody heard the same company superintendent's speech, and we ignored it. But anyway, there you have it, and they danced all night, and the bands would quit at 11:30, and then everybody threw money on the stage. Sheaf of snow along the side of the building was called a was where the liquor was kept and refreshment. You just go out there and help yourself during the dance. And there you see people enjoying themselves. Work hard, very respectable, very kept. Concentrate went out in 38. And there's a slide of the celebration they had in Chelan in April of 1938 at the dock, the old dock that sits over by where you get on the boat down at Chelan. It's all rotted now. It's like the other one. There was only two rotten pilings at the time that the Lutherans had to burn down the old dock here in Lucerne and replace it with their own dock. Here in 1938, we have all kinds of dignitaries. RK, the Movie Tone News is there, recording this. And a big flotilla of boats is escorting it down. A group of citizens from the Northwest came up and followed the first slurry down, and they had a big town party, and then they all went down and got in their boats and followed it down there and then waited for it. And the high school band came out, and they put together a big parade and shut down the town of Chelan for a half day and had a big parade all the way to Chelan Falls. You know, you kind of look back and you kind of chuckle, you know, and you say, when's the last time you've ever seen a town close its school for a half day and use the marching band to welcome a new business to town? Sometimes you think maybe we better start acting that way. But anyway, that's another point of view. As they went through all the hot air of the speeches and that, and they got done talking about what a grand thing this was, this $3.5 million building of this mining community. So they got through all of it, and everybody said what a great guy and gal and everything was, and everybody was, what a swell. And they all went off marching down to Chelan Falls, to the town of Chelan. You know, they forgot one thing. They forgot to mention anything about the man who discovered it and for 18 years had worked very hard on it. Nobody said a thing about J.H. Holden, nor his wife, nor his kids, nor anybody. But everybody, you know, they talked a little about Crooker Perry, but they talked about Howe Sound. Howe Sound was, that went in for totally about $4.5 million. It yielded about $3.5 million a year to the local North Central Washington economy. They took it for granted, just like they probably take Holden Village for granted today, out of sight, out of mind. Let me tell you, there was as much spirit then as there is now. This was a cabin. There were lots of cabins around here. This happened to be J.H. Holden's cabin way up there. And as time, you know, as time came along, the cabin had disappeared. And over the years, as people were kept off the hillside by the company, the brush grew up. And as Honeymoon Heights was burnt down after World War II, the brush continued to grow. That's J.H. Holden's cabin, as it looked some years later, buried back in the brush. His son eventually pointed out to the village people where it was. Apparently some logs, the bottom logs, had rotted away. And the cabin had fallen down in the brush just enough so that it was hard to see back in the little place there in a little notch back up in the hillside. There's mining cars up there on the hillside. They'll tell you about that. But anyway, that's the way it was, moving west. That's just kind of a little gathering for you. Thank you very much. Mike? Any questions you'd like to ask? Any questions? I mean, you've had a big dinner and you're about ready to have a wonderful Vespers. Any questions? Well, it was fun being here. Nice to see everybody. Nice to see you, Leo, again. And hope you can get it in the bookstore over here. It's in the back there. History of the Holden Mine from Discovery to Production. Fill in all the details there. Don't forget, the profits go to the village. I dedicated that profits of that thing to the village. Okay. Well, I'm working on a second one on the production years themselves. Okay. Then I'll probably be psychologically released from the trauma of having had to leave Holden in the summer of 1957. It's a very special kind of place. It's basically it came down to this. People didn't know what they had until they left. The company had a policy if they could hire the best people they wanted in mining, milling, in engineering, and management, and they got the best. But they had a really neat policy. And the policy established by Carlton Browning, who later, after he left mining in Canada, went to Berkeley and became a psychiatrist and spent the rest of his years as a psychiatrist. For reasons unknown to me, he was very progressive, he was way out in front of everybody in Canadian mining, and especially just with this experiment. Basically, he said that nobody with a college degree should ever be given a specialty job until they spent at least 1 to 2 years working alongside those people who had learned it in the School of Hard Knocks. Then they could go become the geologists they'd been trained to be. The result was that people met each other like this rather than like this. And it didn't hit a lot of people till after they left Holden, the kinds of, the way that helped to break down, you know, what was just a geographic barrier and the class system that some of the British Columbia, the Britannia Beach, were then called Howe Sound when it was reincorporated in the United States. When Howe Sound's original Canadian mining management team came in here, they tried to impose the Canadian class system initially. Well, it didn't work. Americans didn't buy into it. And he was very perceptive of that, so he watched the rebellion proceed, and he got head full carte blanche then to proceed with helping to make sure that this place work differently. Now, you could have booze here, but the tavern was in Lucerne. You could have it imported, okay? And but that wasn't big. The idea was there was work here, and you probably shouldn't work here if you couldn't make more, twice your wages every day doing, you know, by the tonnage. If you worked by the hourly wage, whether it was union scale or not, you were probably, and you couldn't double your, on the bonus system, you shouldn't live here, shouldn't work here. People were kind of screened to come here, and coming here, just probably like the staff has to be to come here. People were watched very closely, and reports were sent back to New York City every day, who came and who left. I don't know if they do that here, back to St. Paul, Minneapolis, or wherever it is. Maybe everybody would leave, no? Are there any questions, really? If you have any questions, you know, there's a lot of wonderful people here. Like I said, Mike Grogan's over here with all week, and he's got a lot of things he can tell you. I'll be at 11 o'clock, I believe it is tonight, over in Koinonia. 10 o'clock, thank you very much, so I can get to bed tonight. And Leo and will be in Donkey Lake tomorrow, and we left some for you. Well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to Vespers. Let's take a break.